Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say. Today is the day. Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings here for the 5th of December. It was a great first hour of the show. If you're listening in, we had a chance to talk with Galen Carey, who's the Vice President for Government Relations for the National Association of Evangelicals, and he was cluing us in a little bit about some of the tax implications that churches are facing with what was hidden in this tax cut bill, at least to some degree, that churches are facing a 21% tax on transportation-related reimbursements that they might offer to their pastors and the rest of their staff, same with nonprofits as well. So great segment, and encourage you to call your representatives, your houses of Congress, your senators, to encourage them to vote against this tax in next week's vote. And of course, at the top of the hour, we are talking with Drew Griffin of Providence Magazine. Did a great job walking us through so many of the global headlines. And now I'm looking across the studio at Bill English of BibleandBusiness.com, who joins us regularly on Wednesday mornings. But Bill, seems like I haven't seen you in about 8 weeks. You travel the globe. You go to Israel. You hold conferences. You're this very important person. So when I get you in the flesh like this, I feel so honored, Bill.
Well, and you're down at Disney doing who knows what for 2 weeks,
well,
right?
Actually, there's a contrast. You're doing things in Israel. You're studying the Word of God. You're helping people in business. And I guess I'm just indulging in Disney. So I don't know what it says about our spiritual character, Bill.
Well, you are forming five beautiful people to be followers of Jesus Christ and impactful in the kingdom.
I am.
That's what you're doing.
Are you helping me make a bridge between that and Mickey Mouse at this point?
Something like that.
Well,
yeah.
I appreciate the effort at this point. So we've been talking with our different guests throughout this week, Bill, about their favorite Christmas song. And I just mentioned this to you, that I was going to ask you this question during the break. And you said it was going to be an answer that I wouldn't expect. So I'm a little bit on pins and needles over here, Bill.
So you know the movie White Christmas?
Yes, I've heard of it.
Yes, with Danny Kaye and Bing Crosby.
Yeah, yeah.
Whoever it was.
Seems like it's a classic, yes.
So at the end, they one of the last songs in the movie, they do a show. They're doing a show on the show, and when I was mustered out, I thought without a doubt that I was through with all my care and strife, and that is one of my favorite Christmas songs.
That is so, see, now Rachel Sutton is looking, and she looks a little flummoxed over here, the producer. I just got done complimenting her for being on point, that when Galen Carey referenced Joy to the World, she had it in about 10 seconds. She is paralyzed and frozen over there, and I don't even know for sure if she knows the song that we're talking about. Rachel, do you have any insight into this?
I do not, I'll need a title.
You got to get beyond the title here. You got to go to lyrics.
Yeah, okay. You're going to have to Google those lyrics, Rachel, because we're expecting sometime in the next half an hour that we're going to go in or out of break with one of Bill English's favorite songs. We've got to honor our guests on Faith Radio Mornings, Rachel.
Okay, yes.
Bill, so any other, as we're talking about some of these traditions, any sort of Advent traditions that you guys enter into?
Well, we always read the Christmas story on Christmas morning. We usually open one gift on Christmas Eve at our house, And we try to have people over either Christmas Eve or Christmas Day who don't have a place to go. And this year I decided that I would really like to do a prime rib and some shrimp. So I'm going to be cooking a prime rib probably on Christmas morning. And then we'll have that for lunch. And we're going to have some shrimp. And you and the missus and your five kids are invited, Peter, because I know you don't have any place to go other than Disney.
See, I just was going to ask, I was going to invite myself, but this is just another example of your spiritual formation versus mine, is that you are, in a self-sacrificing way, willing to provide prime rib for us.
Yes, I will be happy to provide prime rib. You guys got to make it to Maple Grove. Right.
You want to give your address out over the air right now?
No.
So that's the voice of Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com. Looking forward to our segment, Bill, coming up next. We're going to talk a little bit about an interesting age in which people tend to start companies when they're most successful. So more with Bill English of BibleandBusiness.com next on Faith Radio Mornings. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings for the 5th of December here. We're chatting with Bill English of BibleandBusiness.com. And Bill, when you sent me some of the information to chat about this morning, you referenced that, yes, the topic itself is important, but what the topic represents really goes to the heart of what you care about at BibleandBusiness.com. So tell us a little bit more about that.
It is. It's all about stewardship of your business for the purposes of expanding and growing and furthering the kingdom of God on this earth. I propose that if a guy or a gal really wants to get involved, be at the ground zero of furthering the kingdom of God, start a business.
Hmm.
And the reason for that is because once you have started a business and you have a successful business, you now have been given an entrustment by God to steward that business. 2 talents, 5 talents, 10 talents in the Luke 19 sense,
right?
To steward that business to further the kingdom of God, not to further your own financial ends. And so, you know, there isn't one church, there isn't one ministry, there isn't one parachurch organization, there isn't one Christian college.
Hmm.
None of these ministries exist without profitable businesses.
Yeah.
You have to have a profitable business behind it. And so if you want to be at ground zero of ministry, go start a business.
Now, you at the Platinum Group have worked, obviously, with many businesses over the years.
Yeah, we have.
Is this what would you say is sort of a percentage-wise, or do you see this pretty common that business leaders have this kind of perspective, even Christian business leaders?
No.
So tell us more about that.
No, most Christian business owners know that they're good for writing the check at church, and they write checks to other ministries, and God usually knits their hearts with a particular ministry or series or group of ministries, and that's what they give to. In my mind, that's the outcome is there, but they don't consciously understand the breadth and the depth of their stewardship responsibilities before the Lord. Look, there's, according to the Census Bureau, there's only about 6 million businesses in the United States, and roughly only 18,000 of them have 500 or more employees. About another 110,000 have between 100 and 500 employees. The rest of them are 100 employees and under.
Hmm.
And when you look at that group, when you look at that group of 6 million businesses, I'm going to guess that 2 million of them are owned by Christians. I'm just guessing because there's no stats on this, right? So I'm going to guess that 2 million of them are owned by businesses. You divide that by 3,300 counties, you're in about 50 to 75 per county in the United States. Those are the businesses that support all of our ministries.
Mm.
All of our ministries.
And that's significant when it comes to the ideas. I was talking with Gail and Carrie last hour a little bit about a tax levied on churches, that if the federal government gets involved in taxing churches and nonprofits, then we're talking about what you described as the funding power for so many of these churches and nonprofits is coming from private capital, private business, and suddenly the government is involved in a different way on some of that.
It's probably just a mistake on somebody's part when they wrote the bill, quite honestly.
Yeah.
Because our laws are so complex and so intertwined, I think it's tough to write a bill that isn't in conflict with another bill in one form or fashion. I don't know that there's a nefarious intent there on the part of either Republicans or Democrats.
Yeah, that's good. I'm curious, too, what you would say when business owners are thinking about the use of cash and capital, and it's not just writing a check for a church and sort of wiping our hands of it. I know my roommate and I that I roomed with for 3 years at university back in the day, we had one of those typical 20-year-old kinds of conversations in which we kicked around almost the entire evening the question, can a Christian own a BMW? And so one of the questions that I have is for a business leader, how did they balance the use of cash for their own needs? I mean, is a Honda enough? Is a used Toyota Camry enough? Can they have a BMW? Should they be giving all their money to organizations? Do you have any suggestions along these lines, Bill?
I do. Live at the mean of your community.
Say more about that.
Live at the mean of your community. It's the same way we decide how do we pay pastors. You pay pastors in one of three ways. Either you take the elder board salaries, average them, pay the pastor that.
Hmm.
Or you go to the census and you find out what a person with a master's degree, most of them have MDivs, what does a person with a 3-year master's degree make in this community? Pay them that, okay? Third way is call around all the churches and find out what their pastors make, average it, pay them that. Seems to me that a business owner finds himself in a Maple Grove where I live or finds himself in a Waseca or finds himself in Hartford, Connecticut, wherever it is, what's the mean, the median, in other words, the middle of the road living standard, that's where the business owner should live.
Yeah, money, vocation, finance, salary, all of those kinds of things get tricky when dealing with churches. And so this seems like it might be at least one suggested way to just sort of take all the starch out of that conversation and focus on the things that matter.
I really like the idea of the elders saying, here's what we make, and everybody just being God honest, because money is not, in my mind, is not an assessment of one's value to the kingdom. How much money you make is really a stewardship issue. If you, Peter, if you make $300,000 a year and I make $100,000 a year, I don't interpret that as you're better than me. I interpret that as you have more responsibility before the Lord than I do, right? And so you just take the elder's salaries, average it, pay the pastor that.
Well, even though those salary numbers are just right spot on, Bill, of course, I'm still expecting you to buy my prime rib here for Christmas Eve lunch.
I am going to make you the best prime rib you've ever had.
Love it. Talking to Bill English of BibleandBusiness.com, and I think we have some interesting news for you relative to your favorite Christmas song.
Oh, what's that?
Here, Bill. Well, you know, we were kind of giving Rachel Sutton a little bit of grief for being on point, but not knowing
well,
this
Well, I had
old
to give her the
Chris
title
song.
Off air.
Well, here we go. Let's listen to Bill English's favorite Christmas song, which is titled I Wish I Was Back in the Army.
Was mustered out. I thought without a doubt that I was through with all my care and strife.
Well, I thought that I was then the happiest of men. But after months of tough civilian life,
I wish I was back in the army. The army wasn't really bad at all. Three meals a day, three for which you didn't pay.
A thrill of hope. The weary world rejoices, for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn. Fall on your knees, oh,
and of course, that is the music of O Holy Night. And Bill, that that helps cleanse the palate a little bit after your choice of music on the, you know, we've been having these sacred moments of songs. We've been reading from Isaiah 9 this morning. We've been celebrating the birth of the king. And suddenly I'm dancing around wishing I was part of the army. So I appreciate it. Sounds like O Holy Night
is
another one that might actually rank as a favorite of yours.
In all seriousness, that is my favorite Christmas hymn because it is so worshipful. Fall on your knees. Oh, you know, let hear the angels' voices, you know.
It's a very powerful song. There's a theological depth and richness of
that
I think is really profound. I know I'm interviewing for a taped interview later today, Andrew Peterson, singer-songwriter, and he brings that kind of substance and depth and richness into the music. And there's something just really anchoring that we're part of a story that has been going on for thousands of years, and it's the story that really knows no end. And in all of the trouble and turmoil of today, that's one of those things that really anchors us to who we really are.
You know, the older hymns are so rich theologically, and many of the choruses we now sing in church are really thin theologically, and some of them are just wrong theologically.
Yeah.
And so I wish that we would go not back to the hymns, but we would figure out a way to make this generation aware of the hymns. I actually sit because we never sing hymns at my church.
Right.
Ever.
Right.
And so I sometimes sit by myself in my devotional time in the morning, and I have a hymnal, and I sing some of these hymns because they're just so rich.
Yeah, you referenced the theological depth of some of the hymns and the traditions. It was coming at a time in which it wasn't business mixing with music. And so much of the music these days is being released to make a living and business. But when you read the hymns of the past, it was being birthed out of a theological conviction of a sense of who God was. And I think that's part of why there's such richness in some of that music.
I would agree.
So I know that one of the topics that we wanted to get into this morning in a little bit that I was a little surprised by when you're dealing with businesses and startups, and I would have thought the average age for starting a business and being an entrepreneurial person would be at an early age when it makes some sense, supposedly, to take a financial risk. And so I have a picture of the Stanford dropout sitting in their garage trying to put together some sort of technological innovation that's going to rock the world. But it sure sounds like the most successful entrepreneurs come at a much later age.
And that's because they've been in business for a while, they've made some mistakes, so when they branch out, they know what not to do, and they also know what to do. And so the average age of a successful entrepreneur is 45, according to this article that I read yesterday. And I've read other articles that even peg that in the early 50s. So the right time to start a business is probably late 30s to early 50s. After you have been around the block a couple of times in business and you've seen what works and what doesn't work, and you are a little bit more mature so the dollars don't impress you. Okay, so let's say you want to start a Subway shop,
yeah,
a Subway sandwich shop,
yep,
right? You're probably going to spend, I'm guessing, $75,000 to $100,000 for the license. You're probably going to have to spend another $30,000 to $50,000 to outfit the store, and then you're probably going to need working capital for 6 months to a year until it starts to cash flow. So you might need $300,000 all,
yeah,
told, $350,000,
right? Makes sense. Yep.
Okay. You can't be impressed by that. You can't be impressed by that number. It has to just be a number on a page, and you're working with it in order to make a long-term goal happen. And so if you're going to start a manufacturing company, you may need several million of investment. Can't be impressed by the dollars. You just have to work with the numbers.
Yeah, there's certainly a maturity level that comes with that. I think my son has been texting me this morning, my 19-year-old, and $50 to him would be an unbelievable windfall at this point. And so the prospect of $300,000 really seems daunting, I think, to many of us. We just never considered these kind of numbers. How does somebody who maybe was laid off from their job, maybe unanticipatedly, maybe doesn't have a lot of rainy day fund in their bank account, how do they begin to generate the kind of capital you describe if they really want to do start a business? Is it securing banking funding? How does somebody go about doing this?
Well, banks never start fund startups. Just forget about banks funding startups. It just doesn't happen. Or if it does, the bank probably isn't going to be around a long time.
Yeah, makes sense.
So you got to find family, friends, angel investors, that kind of thing. You got to find people who are willing to put money into it. If it's a service-oriented business with low barriers of entry, you can go in it yourself, right? You can just start the business yourself. And, you know, if your business is cleaning windows, that's not a hard thing to get started. You know, $30 and you can go. If it's a manufacturing and you need $5 million to get it going, you're going to have to find investors.
Yeah, and certainly I talk to younger people like my son that I referenced that would be interested in potentially starting a business at 19, 20, 21. What advice do you have for younger people that maybe aren't as seasoned as a 45 or 50-year-old in terms of their experience in the business world? What would you say you need to put into place if you're going to have a successful idea? Because many of the most innovative ideas are coming from the younger generation.
The innovation may come from the younger generation, but the capital and the ability to run the business is going to come from older generations. It just is.
Yeah.
So my advice to a 19-year-old, your son, here's what I would tell him to do. First of all, know what you really want to do and what your niche is, and Bill Clinton used to say, stick to your knitting, right? Know what you're going to knit and stick to it, right?
Yeah.
Secondly, know how to manage people. And if you don't know how to manage people, you're going to have to get somebody to do that for you. And then the third thing just left my mind, and I'm going to have to come back to it at some point.
We will give you that opportunity. You know, these gaps begin to happen at our ages, doesn't it?
It does.
I swear, was right there not more than a half a second ago, and suddenly it disappears into cyberspace somewhere. We're talking with Bill English of BibleAndBusiness.com, and we're talking about starting up a business and some of the characteristics required for that. And, Bill, again, I'm a little surprised by this 45-year-old number in terms of this is when people tend to be most successful in their startups. In terms of the seasoning there and what you see, how do people transition from maybe being an employee of an organization for an extended period of time and think about actually being the business owner if they want to start up a business at that age?
You know, one of the ways to do that is to say to the employer that, this function that I do probably could be done better if you are outsourcing it to another business. So how about if I just go ahead and start a business and you guys are my first customer?
Hmm.
I've heard that more than once,
yeah,
or more than several times. Where companies actually found it cheaper to have the employees leave the company, start a business, and hire the company back, or the company hires them back as contractors.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense on that. And in terms of, do you feel the people that are close to you, it's probably not a great idea to get involved in a risky venture like this if you don't have the support of family and some of the close friends, because
right,
this is one of those things
right
that it seems like could tear families apart.
It could, especially at older ages. So, you know, the optimum age, right, we said is 45 to early 50s,
yeah,
to start a business that's successful. But you also don't have a long runway to recover financially if it doesn't go well. So you really need to know what you're doing. One of the things that I was going to mention earlier that I couldn't remember that it's now came back to my mind is this. Why would somebody buy from you?
Yeah.
Why are they going to buy from you as opposed to the other competition in town? You've got to be able to explain that, and you've got to have a compelling reason as to why your service is needed, or your angle or something about your business is so unique that people will buy from you as opposed to somebody else.
Yeah, we have just about a minute left here, Bill, maybe a little longer, but I think that's such an important point that you make, because to focus on the differentiation of what it is that you're offering is far more important than focusing on the passion that you might have, because your passion may not meet what is a need or a niche out all there, but you have to have passion for the business, of
Absolutely.
Course.
Absolutely.
But it's too often, I think, people get into the business world based on a passion that they have, assuming everybody shares that passion, and then they're surprised when they don't have any success in the business.
Well, part of that is because they have such a passion for the service or the product or the domain of knowledge. They have a passion for that, but they don't have a passion for actually running the business.
Yeah.
And that's why you almost always need to bring somebody in to shore up the business side of your passion. I can't tell you how many business owners I've seen where that's the case.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating information. This time goes so quick.
It does.
With you, Billy. It really does.
It does.
And maybe we'll actually start seeing each other a little bit more over the next
so.
Month in the Christmas time. And I know that Rachel Sutton was dying to play again. What is your favorite Christmas song? I wish I was back in the Army. Here we go. Bill, have a great weekend.
Hey, you too. Take care.
Gee, I wish I was back in the Army. The Army wasn't really bad at all. 3 meals a day, 3 for which you didn't pay. Uniforms for winter, spring, and fall. There's a lot to be said for the Army.
Up next on Faith Radio Mornings, we'll be joined by Dr. Paul Kengor of Grove City College, who actually had a chance to meet President George H.W. Bush, and we'll get some reflections from Paul on that. And as we head into break, we'll play a listener choice, a listener texting in asking for Mary Did You Know as their favorite Christmas song. Yesterday on Faith Radio Mornings, we were chatting with Dr. Rosemary Stein, and she was reminding us that we should absolutely tell our children our perspective on dangerous activities, because they do sometimes listen.
It's as much as what we don't say as what we do say, and so when we don't give them our perspective, our experience, they take away a big message. And even if you're not giving them that message, they're receiving that message through social media, through school, through their friends. And so they have their own load of information. So if you think your kids don't listen to you, it's still important to get that message out. I try to talk to my patients about marijuana, about waiting for sexual activity every time I get a chance, because I figure each one of those times, it's going to get in there, and it's going to make some sort of difference, and they're going to think about it, even if they look like they're not listening to me.
I always appreciate Rosemary's perspective on some of these issues. As a pediatrician, she doesn't just focus on the physical health of our children. She really works with them on a psychological and social standpoint as well. So if you want to catch that entire segment, you can go to myfaithradio.com and search for Dr. Rosemary Stein. Well, I see that Dr. Paul Kengor is already on the line, and we're going to talk with Paul next about the life and the legacy of George H.W. Bush. And Paul actually had a chance to meet him, if I understand correctly. So more to come with Paul Kengor on Faith Radio Mornings next.
We hear a lot about bullying in school these days. How to recognize bullies, how to stop them, and how to teach our children to face a bully with boldness. But where do these kids learn to be bullies? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. There's only one thing worse than a bully, and that's making the mistake of raising one. Kids learn how to treat people by watching how mom speaks to the cashier at the store, how dad yells at drivers when they cut him off in traffic. These are little instances, but let me tell you, your kids may grow up to be just like you. Is your kid becoming a bully by living with you? Let's make sure we're modeling strength with kindness and conviction with compassion.
Want more help from Mark Gregston? Find books and other resources online at parentingtodaysteens.org. That's parentingtodaysteens.org.
Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings here for the 5th of December, in which we've been celebrating and talking quite a bit about the life and the legacy of the former President George H.W. Bush, who passed away here in the last week or so. And, of course, his funeral is today to be held at the National Cathedral. His son, George W. Bush, eulogizing his father. I'm sure it's going to be a poignant moment this morning. And to help us reflect on the life of President Bush, we've asked Paul Kengor to join us this morning, who at one point, I believe, even met the president as part of his work in politics and journalism. Good morning, Paul.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Well, it's great to talk to you. I'm doing well. Certainly enjoy this time of year, Advent and Christmas. Do you have any specific Advent kinds of traditions that you do?
Well, we lit our Advent candles wreath on Sunday, first day. And so we go through a particular candle each week and say a particular set of prayers. And so we definitely try to treat it, you know, with the literal meaning of the word, right? Awaiting the advent, the coming of the birth of the Messiah. So we do take it very seriously around here, and my wife is better about it than I am with all of these things. So she's really, I think, probably the spiritual leader of the house, making sure we all say prayers and do these things. And but it's a very important time of year, and I'll just say this now. One thing that always bothers us about the Christmas season is how, for so much of our culture, secular culture, and also unfortunately for many Christians, Christmas ends December 26th, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You open the gifts on the 25th, and then it's all over, and you hear people talk about this Christmas letdown, and in fact, it begins on the 25th. So, I mean, it's really, truly a Christmas season, and I think for Christians, we need to really appreciate that and partake in the fullness of it.
Well, and certainly what you referenced, Paul, too, I know that there's always so much angst and anguish about, gosh, I wish Christmas wasn't so commercialized. I wish it wasn't just all about the presents on Christmas morning. But paying attention to the liturgical calendar like this and recognizing that Christmas goes past the actual day and into Epiphany and some of these different events can really put Christmas and the day as a celebration in its proper perspective.
Well, that's right. And I had somebody at my church who absolutely refused to put a Christmas tree up prior to Christmas Eve. And really tried to talk me into it. And I said, well, it's probably one where I'm just going to have to bow to the culture on this one, right? I mean, I'm not going to be able to do that on Christmas Eve. So we usually get the tree around Thanksgiving, usually the weekend after Thanksgiving. But that's right. And, you know, it's one of those things where following a liturgical calendar like that really helps. I mean, you've got a couple thousand years of church tradition, and you know, we have, you know, many, many centuries of previous Christians and church fathers who've you know, as G.K. Chesterton said, we should listen to our ancestors, our so-called democracy of the dead. We've got something to learn from the people who've come before us. They've tried and true, tried and tested. They've been through all of this before.
Well, and certainly when we think about these kinds of things, like you're describing, Paul, it does anchor us in a bigger story, and that really provides some perspective in the midst of all of these headlines that we seem to be dealing with, and I know you deal with each day, including some of the recent events, obviously, that's captured our country, and that was the passing of George H.W. Bush. And boy, it sure seems to be pretty unanimous across even party lines and from world leaders that people really respected this man for his character and his moral leadership.
Yeah, he was a good man. He really was. I've used the phrase old school a number of times in the last few days, and I mean, he was part of that great generation of World War II. He was pretty much, I'm pretty sure it's always been said this way. I've probably found somebody in the last few days who's found something different, but it's always been said that he was the youngest pilot shot down in World War II. He was he dropped out of school at Yale, where he was captain of the baseball team, played first base, and went as, you know, and did it as young as he possibly could, signed up to be a pilot in World War II. And amazingly, there's actually footage of him being pulled out of the water. Well, I don't know, you know, how, and maybe in the workings of Providence, somebody happened to have a movie camera to capture that moment, right? I mean, you know, nowadays everybody in that ship would have probably had a phone, and they could have filmed it on a phone if they had been allowed. But in those days, it just happened to have somebody with a camera filming. Somebody could have said, this guy that you're fishing out of the water right now is going to be the 41st president of the United States. I mean, nobody would have believed that. But he was the quintessential gentleman. I know many people who knew him who said he was a really nice man, genuinely interested in you. And you know, like you alluded to, Peter, I met him. It was June 2004 in Erie, Pennsylvania. And the reason that I met him, I had just published God and Ronald Reagan, and which he read or knew about, and I was actually researching God and George W. Bush, my second kind of faith-based book on presidents. And I had friends in Erie who said, hey, he's going to be in town. We'd like to introduce you to him. So I met him. I spent a few minutes with him, and he was just interested in what I had to say, wanted to talk to me, wanted to ask me questions. And when I told him, we talked a little bit about Ronald Reagan, who had just died, and he had just spoken at Ronald Reagan's funeral. And I said, I want to tell you, Mr. President, what you said at Reagan's funeral was very touching. Because I don't know if you remember this, Peter, but he got choked up a little bit, and he said, Ronald Reagan taught me more than anybody that I ever knew. And he said, oh, I really meant that. He really did. And then I told him, I said, by the way, I'm working on a book right now on the faith of your son. And he said to me, on George. I said, yeah. He said, George? And I said, yeah, it's going to be probably called God and George W. Bush. He said, oh, wow. And I said, well, that's interesting. And then we talked a little bit about Ron Reagan, the son of Ronald Reagan, who's an atheist. And he even said, Ron's an atheist. And I said, yeah, I know, it's kind of a shame. He said, an atheist. And I said, yeah, I know. But we talked for a few minutes, and they had to eventually separate us because he had to meet probably 500 people. But it was a nice moment. Now that I think of it, I have a picture of the two of us somewhere. I don't even know where it is. But I should dig that out. But he was just a true gentleman, a really nice man.
Well, you weren't being pulled out of the water with him at the same time when that picture was captured, were you, Paul?
No, absolutely. But that'd be a great picture right there.
That would be great. Yeah. Talking with Paul Kengor this morning, reflecting on the life and the legacy of George H.W. Bush. Love the story. It's such a poignant story, and it sounds like in person the man was every bit the gentleman that he would have been perceived to be in public. And, Paul, when we come back from break, I want to get a little bit more into his life, including some of the things that would have impacted him at a very early time in his life, including the death of his daughter, and as well as a really touching tribute we saw yesterday from Bob Dole, as 95 years old, stood up out of the wheelchair and saluted the former president. So more to come with Paul Kengor next on Faith Radio Mornings.
It's a miracle to the world, and it's impossible. It's a miracle to the mind, and it's a miracle.
And Joseph said, why me? I'm just a simple man of trade.
That song is A Strange Way to Save the World, coming from another listener request for their favorite Christmas song during this time of year. Paul, we've been asking our guests this week, do you have a specific favorite Christmas song that just really dials the end of the season?
Boy, that's a good question. Probably something like White Christmas by Bing Crosby. I mean, they're mainly secular songs. And I mean, Nat King Cole, his Christmas song as well. Beginning of the year when I hear Andy Williams, you know, that classic piece. These are all kind of songs that connect me to my grandmother's house, you know, back in growing up in the 1970s. So I can't say that I have a favorite, though.
I love those kind of connections you describe, though. There's something about aromas and music and songs and stuff that really right. connect us to our past. It's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. And I remember driving to my grandmother's house with my parents and my siblings. And my grandmother was 100% Italian, and we would go in, and there'd be the smell of anchovy rolls and the seven fishes that she would cook. It was part of the annual Christmas ritual that they did there. And I remember driving literally up through the mountains of western Pennsylvania, and my dad would have these songs on AM radio kind of late at night on a Friday night, always snowing like crazy. And so those are some of my memories.
Yeah, I love how it just anchors us, as we talked about in that first segment. And Paul, too, we were talking in the first segment quite a bit about the life and legacy of George H.W. Bush. And I see on your site, visionandvalues.org, part of what you lead for a Grove City College, that you posted an article just reflecting on some of the difficult events that really made an impact on George and Barbara's life growing up. And that was the loss of their child. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it was the loss of their child, Robin. And Robin was only 3 years old, so this would have been the fall of 1953, and she seemed lethargic, tired. They didn't know what was going on with her, but they could tell something wasn't right. They took her to a woman in West Texas, Midland, Texas area, a pediatrician who was kind of renowned as the most famous pediatrician in all of West Texas, Dorothy Weiler, I think was her name. And she said, this child has very serious cancer, leukemia. It was absolutely not what they expected at all. It came on that quick. And so the father, using whatever connections he had, George H.W. Bush, they flew her as quickly as possible to New York's Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, which is basically the best cancer center in the United States at that point. And over the next few weeks, through many blood transfusions, a lot of pain, and all during that time, it was Barbara Bush who was the sort of lion. She was the one who would cradle her daughter and hold her hand during the blood transfusions. And George H.W. Bush said it was so hard for him to watch that he had to leave the room. He couldn't take it. He couldn't sit there and watch it. And it was during that time that Robin pretty quickly succumbed. She died. And by the way, Barbara Bush's hair went white during those few weeks in New York. It was that devastating to the Bushes. And a really moving quote from her, from Barbara, she said of Robin, "One minute she was there and the next she was gone. I truly felt her soul go out of that beautiful little body. For one last time I combed her hair and we held our precious little girl. I never felt the presence of God more strongly than at that moment." Yeah. And George H.W. Bush said that, he said, "We truly learned the meaning of grief when Robin died." So that, and when Barbara died just a few months ago, I think it was in April that Barbara Bush died, you kind of had a sense too, Peter, that George H.W. wasn't going to be around much longer after his wife went. And before she died, they asked her, what do you want? Any last requests? And she said something to the effect of, I just want to go to heaven and see Robin. And in the case of George H.W. Bush, they said that among his final words was that he said he didn't want to go back to the hospital. He wanted to die at home. And he said he was looking forward to being reunited with Barbara and Robin. So they never forgot the death of that little girl. That she died 65 years ago, and it probably wasn't a day in their life that went by since then when Robin's parents weren't thinking about her.
Yeah, it's such a powerful story, Paul. I mean, certainly those people who have lost a child, it marks you for a lifetime. It's something that you can never sort of let go of, and for understandable reasons. So some beautiful stories at the end of his life. And it does speak to this idea that we're part of a kingdom that knows no end and celebrating the Christmas season in that way. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. I love the perspective. Again, great article you posted. I encourage all of our listeners to go to visionandvalues.org and read the article with Paul Gengor about the life and legacy and the passing of George H.W. Bush. And Paul, as we go to break, I want you to know that our producer, Rachel Sutton, who's been on point all morning, is giving us Nat King Cole, Away in a Manger, just for you.
In a manger. no crib for a bed. The little Lord.
Well, that's it for another morning here on Faith Radio Mornings. Listen again tomorrow morning. We want to get your requests for your favorite music. We'll be playing it all throughout the next three weeks as we celebrate the holiday season.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.